So we found this run-down little house on the edge of the slum. We go out into the slum, choose who comes to the school. They have to be the most destitute children. And we're in an area of 200,000 in our slum.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I am joined, as always, by Tim.
Trusted and loyal. Good day to you, sir.
I'll let both of those go through to the keeper. Now, Tim, we do a podcast about people living lives less ordinary, and we're interested in how they fill their unforgiving minutes. Now, we've spoken to some pretty incredible folk over the last number of episodes, and in many ways, people are achieving spectacular things. Our guest today is someone who is doing just that, definitely filling her unforgiving minutes, definitely leading a life less ordinary.
And definitely living a life less selfish.
And that's the big difference. She is doing all of this for other people. Now, we're recording here in Perth. Let's go halfway around the world to Kenya. Let's go to the capital city of Nairobi, and then let's travel 160 kilometres northwest of that capital city. We'll get to the fourth largest urban centre in that country. And then let's go a further 2 km out of that urban centre into a slum area named Kaptembwa, where over 200,000 people live in pretty much abject poverty. No food, no clean drinking water, no sanitation.
And this story starts in 2008.
2008.
With one Australian with nothing. No money, just an idea and a commitment to do something bigger than herself.
And as we're going to find out, a burning passion, a burning drive, and a pretty amazing attitude. Fast forward to the current day, and we would find in that slum a thing called the Nakuru Hope Gabriel Learning Centre and Orphanage, which was founded by our guest, Susan Saliba, in 2008 and has been built up to where it is today. We're going to talk to Susan about the catalyst for this, what caused her to want to start this incredible endeavour, and what she's seen, learnt, and built along the way.
Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. We have an extremely special guest today, all the way from Kenya. We're joined by Susan Saliba. How are you?
Fantastic. Good to be home.
Cold here?
Bloody cold.
We're recording in the middle of Perth's winter. For our Northern Hemisphere listeners, it's a pretty lame winter. We get down to maybe 5 degrees Celsius, but compared to Kenya?
Kenya is beautiful. Yeah. You know, we're on the equator, and so it's just beautiful every day.
So why don't we start by telling us how you got to where you are today? Not here in Perth, but where you're at in
lost.
Kenya.
It's kind of a twofold story, is that I always knew what I wanted to do right from the early age, and I don't know what drove me to that. But it wasn't until I reached around about 50 that I wanted to volunteer, just like everybody else should. Excuse me. And so Africa has always been, you know, my calling card. It's I've always not so much romanced about it, but it's the beauty of it and so forth. I've heard so much about it. And so I decided to volunteer and I went with an international organisation, I shan't mention their name, to volunteer, and I found out that volunteering is damn expensive. So my first volunteering experience was for 3 months, and when I got there, I wanted to do so much. My God, you want to save the world when you first get there. Yeah. And you want to do it now. I wanted to put in floors into this little school that I was given as my project. And so I had asked for some money back from this international organisation who said that they would. But however, it just doesn't work like that. So I decided to do it myself. Luckily, I was married at the time. Not luckily I was married, but luckily I had this little plastic credit card.
Yep.
So I kept putting it in that little machine and money just came
out. Coming
out. It's amazing.
Magic.
It doesn't happen anymore, but it was good then. And so I was I put in cement floors in this school and also chairs and so forth. And after my 3 months, I realized, you know, it was like a teardrop in the ocean. Mm. It was nothing. It meant a lot to the kids there. They used to live on the they still do live on the rubbish dump there in a place called London Hilton. Fabulous name for rubbish dump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I decided then to go back home, and I was an absolute bitch to live with. I really was. I used to have the life. I used to live in Cottesloe, in a fabulous street, John Street, Cottesloe. Mm. And I went to the boat shed there, and there was this lady who complained about her kumquats weren't ripe enough.
So for our listeners out of Perth, the boat shed is a very high-end fruit, veggie, delicatessen.
Yeah, you take out a mortgage before you
take
enter
They call it the blood shed in some
quarters. I can see why now.
Very expensive. So it must have been this culture shock. You've just come
It was incredible culture shock.
Yep.
And when this lady complained about her kumquats, unfortunately, I couldn't help myself, but I told her where she could almost put her kumquats.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I was asked to leave the boat shed. I haven't gone back. But the thing is that it is a terrible culture shock. Some people get culture shock when they go to a third world country. I got culture shock when I came back. Mm. Took me months to get used to the little trolley and going into a supermarket and just putting food into that supermarket, putting it home on the shelf. 3 months later, you still see that same can. Mm. You know, it was just an absolute shock. So I decided then that I needed to do more. So I went back and started doing it myself.
We're going to get to Nakura Hope in a second.
Mm.
I'm really interested. You mentioned it was obviously a turning point for you doing that first volunteer experience in a number of ways. You mentioned you're almost sort of naive in terms of how much you wanted to help. But I'm really interested in your realisation that the money that was going into that particular organisation was not, all of it wasn't getting to the intended end user.
Mm.
Where was it going?
The funny thing is, a few years later, I was watching something, I don't know whether it was on the ABC or whatever it was, but it was about these people that had made it, you know, in the world, and they lived in, you know, big, beautiful houses and drove fabulous cars and so forth. And it was a lady that was in this particular program that actually owned the agency that I actually volunteered with. And then she was living in this, you know, I mean, she was multimillionaire.
Right.
You know, and that was what the show was about. And I thought, oh, my God, that's horrific.
Yeah.
You know, making money from people like myself, millions of those, that want to give, and she's certainly taking.
Mm.
It's not right.
So you decided to do it better?
Not so much better, but I decided to do it differently.
Okay.
Yeah. I decided after 4 years it took me to go back and forth using my own money to buy, you know, to start my own school, you know. And my ethos is, and it still is 12 years later, that 100% of anyone that donates, it goes to those in need. So my work has been voluntary for 12 years, and I can sleep quite easily when I think about, you know, a donation of little darling lady gives you $5, you know that it's going to go to somebody in need. It's not going on my airfare, or it's not going on my little car.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's the big difference.
So tell us about the school you set up, how you started, how it's built into it, to where it is today.
The very first thing was that when I did get my first project with this international organisation, I met there a gentleman, his name is Christopher Mokoka, Kenyan, young man. And we used to sit in the playground and discuss things. He was a very religious man. I'm not. I am a humanitarian. But the thing is, we used to talk about, you know, how can God, you know, do this for his people. And he said something that always remained with me. He said, well, it's not God, it's man. You know, it is man that's caused so much in our world. You know, God gets the blame. But the thing is that we decided there and then that something must be done. And 4 years back and forth, as I said before, is that we would meet up and he would show me women that have HIV that were ostracized from their village. And so therefore we would go and help them. We would go and help other orphanages. But the only thing is that when I came back each time, everything that I had done had fallen down.
Yeah.
You really needed to be hands-on. You needed to be there.
Constant.
Constant, yeah. Not because of the Kenyans themselves, it's just that the political situation and how it is in Kenya, there's no money coming in, you know, the poor. So one morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, I shall never ever forget, I was sleeping away and my phone rang. It was my daughter, Sarah. And she said to me, and she was absolutely hysterical, and I said, you know, what's the matter? And she said, her pa has died. Her grandfather had died. His name was Gabriel. And I had only spoken to him 2 days beforehand in Kenyatta Avenue. I was in Kenya. And he was in hospital, and he said, it's okay, Susie. He said, I'll be out in a few days. He was Greek. And 2 days later, he died. And I just couldn't get over it. And it was, I know this sounds, you know, strange, but it was almost like an epiphany, you know. I woke up the next morning and I met up with Christopher and I said, got to do my own project and it must be called Gabriel's, you know, after him. Because he was the epitome of family. You know, he held the family together. He was an amazing man, a beautiful, beautiful man. And so I had 2 weeks left in my visa. So I said, Chris, right, I'm a woman of action. So we found this little old house, a run-down little old house on the edge of the slum, and we decided there and then that this would be our school.
Mm-hmm.
But it started off with a school for women, to empower women to be able to learn to sew so that they get their respect and they get their self-worth back so that they can put their own children through school. But we had this little garage at the side, little rundown garage at the side, and I said to Chris, how many kids can we put in there? And he said, 30, about 30. I said, great. So we go out into the slums, and we still do. We go out in the slums, and we choose. It's a terrible word, but we choose who comes to the school. They have to be the most destitute children in the area. And we're in an area of 200,000 in our slum. So we chose our first 30 children.
Can I scene set a little? UNICEF. Some statistics from UNICEF. Infant mortality rates in Kenya are as high as 206 per 1,000 live births in some provinces. More than 10% of Kenya's 15 million children are orphans. A significant number suffer from malaria, diarrhea, acute respiratory infections, and higher levels of malnutrition. And this is quite startling. A third of all new HIV cases every year are children. That's the cause you're working on, Susan.
Absolutely. And that is so true. As you read the words, I can see it in front of me.
For every 10 children orphaned by age, 3 to 4 die by the time they're 2 years old.
Yep.
Amazing.
It is amazing. And you don't see that. I mean, to put into perspective, it's yes, you know, I have a school and orphanage and so forth, but I'd say another at least 65% of my work is out in the community itself.
Okay.
So we see that, and we see it daily. We see, I have been in a room, it wouldn't be any bigger than this studio, 11 children, you know, sleeping in there, a mother giving birth behind the door. It is suffocatingly hot. There's no windows. She can't go to hospital because she has no money. I have sat on that floor and helped this woman, you know, give birth. It was the most horrific thing. I had never felt so useless, you know, so uncontrollably, you know, useless. She gave birth, and I won't go obviously into the details and so forth, but there's this child, you know, the umbilical cord still attached, and I think, oh my God, you've come into this world, you know, and all you can do is just love straight away.
Mm.
You know, it's an amazing thing.
Mm.
And that child did not live.
One of the fascinating things I remember about Kenya, having had an office in Parklands there, was the commitment to learning amongst children.
Sponges.
We sponsored a solar light project up near Mount Kenya for one of the schools, and we turned up to present the solar lights, in fact, to the mothers, very maternal system, so that they would care for the solar lights. Some of these kids walked 10 kilometres yep. a day to get to school. And then, of course, 10 kilometres back, no public transport, no transport at all. And by the time they got home, it was pretty much dark. The family could, the wealthy ones, could afford a little gas light that was only used for preparing the meals. So kids mm-hmm. studied under the gas light, and those that didn't have that studied by the cooking fire. One of the fascinating things about the school is that they measured the kids' school marks before and after the solar project, and you know, profound differences.
Mm.
And these kids at the school, of which there were hundreds and only a few teachers, were just, you're right, soaked up all of the learning. They wanted to hear the stories. They entertained us, you know, singing and dancing. Do you have that sort of melodic experience?
You express it so you've said exactly the right thing. We have kids exactly the same, you know, 10 to 12 kilometres they walk to school.
Mm.
And the thing is, we have a policy that their parent must walk, or a carer must walk with them, because child snatching is prevalent over there. The thing is, the mother always walks with that child as well. So she walks 10 to 12 k's to the school to bring that child to school, back. Then she walks again, then back, you know, and then, you know, life goes on for her, hunting, virtually hunting on a rubbish dump, you know, for food, you know, and so forth. And that child comes to school and is, as I said, a sponge. Loves it, just loves it, you know. You cannot teach a child quicker, you know, than I want somebody that really wants it so bad.
Mm. Can we get you to knit a few things together for us?
Mm-hmm.
The women's cooperative that you spoke about right at the start of the interview, what are they now doing for the school?
Ah, good question. Because having just come back, is that it was amazing. I was walking down one of the roads in the slum, and this woman came up to me, and you've got to remember, this is like 10, 12 years ago, and this woman came up to me, and as she's approaching, you know, I'm thinking, ah, she looks familiar, and then she outstretched her arms, and I walked into them, and she, biggest hug, and tears were streaming down her face, and she just said, thank you. You know, and she was one of my very first sewing ladies, and she works for the Betty factory, which is a factory there now. And she was telling me how her children now go to her school. She pays for her children. She was a victim of abuse herself with her husband. He no longer is around, and she is the sole supporter, and she has now a child in high school, you know, and she just said, you know, without me or without us, it would never have happened. So most of our ladies, yes, did get employment. We had an 82% success rate. They were with us for 4 years until we moved into our brand new school. Also, too, is that we now have ladies that make our school uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taught them to sew, and now they make our school uniforms, which we pay them. Plus, too, they have their own clients. They have, and they've still got the same sewing machines. Can you believe it? Little Chinese pedal sewing machines. Mm. So they're doing amazingly well. It's a whole new hub. We even have one lady, Mama Edna, and she has, I think, 5 or 6 people working for her now, you know, and selling her stuff in the markets and so forth.
Mm.
So, you know, you can make a difference.
It's a great story of empowerment. In fact, I look at Ben when I recount the story of Elizabeth Armstrong and some of the work they're doing in Myanmar with women making soap and forcing, bringing cultures together, bringing different sides of ethnic divides together and different religions together.
But also more than just the tangible sewing skills, you know, that ability to create a business and just the hope that you give. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
We have to remember there's 42 different tribes in Kenya.
Yes.
And there's 42 different languages in Kenya. Not everybody can communicate. Swahili is the major language and English obviously now. But the thing is these women were from 42 different tribes. So now they bond together. Tribalism is still very rife in Kenya. But these women now from all different tribes, they sit around, you know, and they talk. You know, and they talk in Swahili, so that's the common language, and it brings them together. And it's like all women; they love to sit and gossip. They love to sit and talk about their children, you know, and so forth.
Some men as well, Susan. We don't mind gossip.
Don't even ask me about the men in Kenya. There are a few really good ones.
That's a great part of the story: the women's cooperative arrangement sewing uniforms for the school.
Yeah.
At the school, there must be a lot of hungry mouths to feed. What are you doing to feed those hungry mouths?
Thank goodness we have a farm. So fundraising and a lot of donations, hard work. But we have a farm. We have 3 and a bit acres. And we do 2,000 meals a week.
Any kumquats?
No kumquats. Careful, I'll tell you. But no kumquats, mainly it's all kale. Kale is very, very sociable, you know.
It's very trendy.
Very trendy here.
Kale in the boat shed.
That's
the
right.
Hipsters will love you.
Over there,
so
we
the kids get kale milkshakes, do they?
No way. Smoothies? They get kale, they get corn. Beans, everything that we grow ourselves. We don't grow rice, of course, which we can't, but potatoes, carrots. We're just trying Brussels sprouts for the next season, cauliflower, and we do marvellously well with cabbages. So without our farm, it would be a huge expense.
Is that part of the kids' learning experience?
Yes. What they do is they come out on the farm as well. So most of our kids know where corn comes from. It doesn't come out of a can. So they've seen it grow. They help us pick it. They help us thrash it, you know, to get the corn and the beans. We have our boys' orphanage on our farm as well. So our boys have got a beautiful, great big area that they can play. Well, they play soccer over there. We have taught them a few football games. But
Australian football?
The Australian rules, yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some phenomenal Australian rules football players now coming out of Africa, particularly some of the Sudanese boys.
They're
not too
amazing.
Far away from Kenya.
Not too far. But the farm is amazing. All the kids help out on the farm. They don't have to. They choose to. And that's another good thing is that you don't tell our kids what to do. They choose to do it. We're one big family. You know, it's amazing. There's no computers. There's no TV. You know, we have computers and we have television, but they're in a place. You know, when time allows it.
And so, Susan, you've spoken about the difference that your programs have made for the women.
Mm-hmm.
What difference does an education make for children in Kenya, for the children you're working with?
I get this question all the time, and the question and it upsets me a little bit because they say, well, after grade 8, we go up to grade 8. So we've had them for 11 years. You know, they come to us just under 3. While they're with us, they learn everything that you could possibly imagine, reading, writing, arithmetic and so forth, but also too the social graces, how to get on with each other, cultural differences and so forth. At the end of 8, obviously we want them to go to high school, and we have some in high school now, and we also too have 5 in university as well.
Wow.
But the thing is that after grade 8, a lot of them will not go on to high school. Their parents just cannot afford it. While they're with us, it's free, but they cannot go on to high school. But stop and think, you know, is that while they've been with us every day or every school day, they've had a meal. They've had their immunizations. They've been taught to interact with different tribes and so forth. They can read. They can read manuals. They can read. They can go into mechanics. They can go into dressmaking. They can go into so many other areas that they just need to pick up a manual, you know, and they can read it. They have a future.
Yeah.
Teenage pregnancy, you know, will be slowly, you know, a thing in the past because they learn, you know, in grade
family
four.
Family planning. And
you know, family planning. A woman has the right to say no. They learn that. I don't know the statistics over in Kenya, but I know it's extremely high that the women are either raped or battered. Our girls, you know, and our boys, know the rights and wrongs. So they've learnt all that, you know, in the 11 years that have been with us. So what they'll get out of it is they'll get all the foundation that they have for their life, you know, the life to come. What they choose to do is just like our children here. What they choose to do with their education is entirely up to them.
We've reflected previously on this changing nature of society here. Our community is definitely getting different. We're interacting less on a street-by-street, neighbourhood-by-neighbourhood basis. What's that word mean over there, community?
Community is everything. A community is it's what holds us together. Over there is that if somebody's starving next door to you, you go and help them. If someone needs something, you go and help them. A community is that they don't have... They're not texting. They're not on their phones. They're not on their computers. We talk. We're worlds apart. You know, you come back here and you wish sometimes you were back in Kenya so that you can sit down in a group of friends, you know, and sit there and talk about the real things that matter in your life, and what they are is things that happen to you yourself and. Community holds it together.
In one of many villages, of course, in Africa, and one of many countries in Africa that has not much, what do they have that we could really do with here, following on from your thoughts there?
A true sense of belonging. A true sense of family, and to protect the family no matter what. Words are softer over there. They're not as harsh. We tend to hold grudges here. They haven't got time or need to hold grudges there. But I think two big things is one is belief, you know, believing in oneself. They have nothing but hope over there. If you don't have hope, you have nothing. Hope feeds them. And believing in yourself. It's too easy here. You know, if I want something, I can go to a psychologist or I can go for a doctor or so. If they're over there, they have nothing like that. They have to. And if I can just interrupt myself, is that we have a little boy and his name's Peter. Peter, he came to us when he was 7. He was abandoned with his brother Joseph and lived on the street. He was cerebral palsy. And we thought, well, shall we put him in a special school? Over there, a special school is horrific. And we said, no, we'll keep Peter in our school. I swear to you now, Peter plays football. He walks with a slight limp. His hands now are not, can be used now. He writes with a pencil. His speech is slightly slow, but he talks and he can understand. Now, that is without, you know, doctors. That is without. I'm not saying that it's for all cases, but at the same time, we see Peter now. His heart is just full of love. His eyes light up. He's alive. You know, and it to us, it's a miracle. And to see a child like that, and God, there's thousands of stories I could tell you about our children, that they're human beings. They're so grateful.
You're a volunteer-driven organisation. Can I ask the question, what makes a good volunteer?
A simple answer is someone that can sit down, hold a hand of someone else into yours and just talk. Just show that they care. these kids are so unloved, you know, that come off the streets. They've been beaten and battered. Just as someone to sit down. They know that you've travelled thousands of miles. They know that it costs money to get there. But you've done it for them. And that's, you don't have to be a doctor or earth mover or whatever. You just have to be somebody with compassion and love for, you know, your fellow man.
Tim and I often ask guests about happiness, and I think we're both really interested in this concept. If we can take you back to the boat shed, the lady complaining about her kumquats as wealth beyond imagination, as most of us do in this country on a relative scale. And yet, in many cases, you don't feel that we in Australia, in this incredibly lucky, wealthy society, are particularly happy on the whole. Do you... Looking at, you know, a slum in Kenya, we'd imagine that everyone would be miserable. Is that the case?
I think there's certain degrees, but I'd have to say I don't see it. Yeah. You know, I see laughing kids. I see mothers, you know, with their pregnant bellies and child on their hip, and you walk past them and they still say, you know, buddy, you know, bumble. You know, they're still welcoming you. They're still saying hello. Yeah, sure, you know, we have the white skin, you know, and we're seen as a dollar sign, you know, in a third world country. But at the same time, there's no resentment for that. We're called Mzungus in the white skin. And so you hear the kids shouting out, "Hello, Mzungu, how are you? How are you?" You know, and you turn around and you say, "We are fine," you know. And the thing is, we are fine. We're doing great, but we're doing great over there.
Mm.
Come over, you come back to your own country, and I think that's where my sadness is in my own country. You know, in my not so much my own life, but you know, I'm far better over there. I'm much more happier over there.
Tim's, did you invent this saying? There is no happiness without struggle. You're claiming it, aren't you?
Pretty sure.
Trust me, it's true.
Tim claims a lot of very wise sayings. We won't fact check them, but potentially that's part of it. You know, it is funny you talking about the children being so happy with this privilege of education and, you know, being stoked with that meal of Brussels sprouts. And I think of my own children serving that up. They turn their little noses up. School seems as this big impost. They're unaware of what a privilege it is to live in the society we do and take these things for granted. You cannot have that happiness without overcoming something, without having actually worked for it.
Sometimes you have to be. I have to be very careful and not resent people, you know, because it's damn hard fundraising. I mean, every day, you know, you may get, you know, 10 no's to a half a yes or a maybe, and fundraising as well is here in Perth. It's been hard for me because I'm a grassroots charity. So you have your friends or you have acquaintances and say, yes, I'd love to come, but I'll be in Italy at that time. And you go, well, no problem. Would you like to make a donation? Oh, God, this trip's cost me a fortune, you know. And once upon a time, I would, you know, maybe, you know, sit over with a glass of wine and maybe have two or three because it was hard. But the thing is, like, you know, you have to get over that. You cannot resent because people have their own, some people have their own way of giving. It may not be monetary, but it might be, you know, in helping in some other way. You just have to be grateful for every cent that you can. Somebody the other day, oh, sorry, it wasn't the other day, a volunteer that we had recently, I said, oh, we're going on house cleaning, you know, tomorrow, which we do in Kenya, and we, you know, take out their rotten floors and kill the bugs and so forth. And she said, oh, well, why don't you just pay someone to do that? And I said, well, the reason we do it is because to show people that we care, you know, and this is why, you know, I do what I do. It's to show that we care, we give them their hope, you know, and so forth. And she said, yeah, but you pay the house lady, you know, who looks after us in our homes down. I said, yeah, that's giving you employment.
Mm.
You know, it's a different thing altogether. So she said, all right, I'll come, you know, if you tell me to come. And I said, no, because if you don't give with the heart, then don't give. And that's the same with donations. You must give with the heart, you know.
Can we talk about giving and specifically the economics of running a school, an orphanage and a farm?
Mm.
What does that cost?
It's July now. Just finished my budgets for this financial year. Mm-hmm. For me,
good timing, that question.
Yeah, it's been a frustrating time.
Now, I'm asking for your accountant, by the way.
Don't worry. He often looks at me and says, you've got to be joking. How can you raise that much money? But for me, it's around about, when I say around about, $367,000 that I have to raise. I don't have committees. I have me. I do everything. But at $367,000, and when I say around about, that's just the basics. That's not, you know, like we've got young boy Dennis who needs another brain.
Has a brain tumor?
Yeah.
Yep.
It's benign, but now it's regrowing again, and it'll have to. It goes back to Nairobi Hospital in October, so that's not knowing whether or not we have to pay another $6,000 to $7,000, you know, dollars. Mm. You know, though we have a sponsor for him, but whether or not that, you know, something else happens and everything happens, no day is the same.
That's an interesting story, the Dennis story. So he came to you as an orphan, as a little boy. He's now 16 years old with a brain tumour and you're providing assistance through.
He's amazing. He's an amazing kid. His family, we have him, his brother John and his sister Fannis. Their mother was, they saw their mother being brutally beaten by the father. She had HIV from the father. She turned around and stabbed him to death. And so the mother went to jail, and therefore the three children were, one was put into like a home for girls where beating happens and sexual abuse happens within the home. Fannis was put in with a family as a house cleaner, and the man of that place continually raped her. She was only 8 or 9. And Dennis used to hide out with us in the school, the little school that we had at right at the beginning. And Christopher, who's an amazing man, this is my school director, the one that I started everything with, is that he found the three children, and we decided then to put them into boarding school because we didn't have an orphanage then. So we put them into boarding school, and then once we had our own orphanage, we brought them home again. Now, poor Dennis, he had all this going on, and then he was having seizures, and so we took him to Nairobi and found that he had this benign tumor. We had a tumor.
Mm.
But before that, Kristen and I had to sit down and say, right, it's going to cost $6,000 to $7,000 for this operation. Do we give it to him?
Because there's opportunity cost there, isn't it?
You know,
it means food for other people.
Yeah. And can you imagine how much money that means to us? It's a fortune for us. You know, do we, if we give him the operation, how will he come out? Will he come out even, you know, with a stronger disability, which will need more caring? You know, what do we do? Well, what would you do when you're a family? Because we are one big family. We said, no, we just got to go with it. And we gave him the operation. He came out fine. He's on medication every day. And now this tumour is growing again, and it's growing into the brain where it can severely disable him. So we find out in October what happened to Dennis. But Dennis is now 18.
Mm.
Now, so when I was there last time, 18-year-olds can't live with us because they're young adults.
Yep.
So I had to start up a halfway house. So we have a halfway house now as well, where the young men, you know, 18 and onwards, until they finish high school and university, they still stay with us. So that's another expense.
Mm.
But we're family. Mm. And so once they finish university, then they're out on their own.
You mentioned your frustration with money that was donated to a not-for-profit that you were working for not actually getting into the field, at least not to 100%. How are donations that you receive used?
Okay. First of all, when you have a school and an orphanage, obviously you've got to build it. So a lot of the donations have gone, you know, in cement and mortar and so forth. Then you have your day-to-day running operational expenses and wages of the Kenyan staff. You get what you pay for. So we give our kids a really great education, so you're paying for those teachers. But we have in all 32 staff, so you've got to pay them. It's not so much just the teachers. You've got your guards, you've got your farmers, you've got your house parents and so forth. Then you've got all the books for 300. I've got 300 children, all the textbooks, 300 pairs of shoes, 300 pairs of shorts, or, you know, they all have to have a tracksuit. I know that sounds bizarre, but it's the Kenyan government law, is that on sports days they must have a tracksuit. So it's everything like a normal school. You walk past a normal primary school here in Perth, is that we're just the same, but we pay for it all. Then you've got your community work. So when we go out into the community, what we do is that we stop at a little, I was going to say a delicatessen or a cafe. It's not like that at all. A little place where you can get flour and butter and so forth. And we'll spend up to maybe $10 to make sure that we've got flour for ugali or chapati, matches for their little choker, the machine, their fires, soaps and so forth. Then we go into our family and we visit them. Instead of taking a bottle of wine and chocolates, you know, we take food for survival. So $10 we'd spend on that. That might keep the family, you know, five, six, for maybe 4 days, 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
$100, if we had $100, the amount of things you can buy for that, you can go and visit 10 families, you know, for $100. So it just depends. Every cent is valuable to us, but we spend it in so many different variables, you know, as well. People say, what project do you have now? What project? What can I donate? What project? And I go, well, gee, I've got my school bus. I've got the I've got the orphanage. I've got the school. I've got 300 kids. That is the project, you know. So money goes, doesn't go far. We're against the American dollar. So our Kenyan shilling is stronger than our, you know, than our Australian dollar when it comes to the difference when you've got to put into American dollars than to Kenyan shillings. So it doesn't go far.
We talked about financial donations. We've talked about donations of time that the volunteers give. What about non-financial donations? Do you accept those?
Yeah, goods in kind, gifts in kind. Yes, we do. We have an op shop, you know, secondhand shop here in Fremantle. And so that op shop has actually built our library and so many things from the proceeds of that. Goods in kind, people ask all the time, can you take clothes over? Can you take books over? Can you do that? And the answer is no. The only reason being is one is the weight. And our airlines, no matter who you fly with, is not great in giving you extra weight. But also, too, is that over there, all the clothes that we don't want here get big bundled up and they go to third world countries. And then people buy those big bundles and they're taken to their markets and then that's their living. So we go over there and we buy our clothes in those markets. So for $10, you cannot carry the clothes back that you buy. And you buy specifically for what your needs are rather than being donated all this stuff, you know, but you don't particularly have a need for it, you know. Same with our books, you know, is the books are so cheap over there. Pens are so cheap over there. Everything is cheaper over there with, you know, in wholesale. And you're helping the community. So we're
putting money back
in. Yeah. All our furniture, all our desks and everything is built in the slum. Everything is in our community.
I have actually seen a Fremantle Dockers jumper walking along the streets of Nairobi. I mean, no one wants a Fremantle Dockers jumper, so I guess they're giving those away.
You'd be amazed the designer labels that you see.
Susan, we've spoken a lot about all the stuff you've done for other people. You're obviously very, very dedicated to helping others. Let's get a little personal and talk about how this has changed you. We spoke right at the start. You said you're living in John Street, Cottesloe, which is a very well-to-do, lovely part of the world.
I don't live there now.
You don't live there now. And you spoke before about a marriage or two.
Don't have them now.
So do you consider these sacrifices? How have you changed over the development of Nakura Hope, the projects you're doing?
God, how long have we got? But as a child, I was abused as a child. I was sexually abused as a child. And also too is that beaten in the, you know, inch of my life as well. It was something that I couldn't come to grips with. And maybe that was one of the reasons, you know, I do what I do, you know, now helping others. But but one way it's changed me, it's come to terms with that, you know. So now I find it okay to talk about it, but that only happened only a few years ago, to actually talk about it. So that's helped me, very cathartic in that particular way. It's given me more, I don't know, it's given me more belief in myself to think that you can do what you set out to do. You know, if you have a dream, you can do it, but you have to pay the price. And I have paid the price, and I won't, you know, dull it over. I have. While I was over in Kenya, unfortunately, I was saving the world and my husband was saving himself with a tall blonde. So, you know, but so it goes, you know. So moving from John Street and having that life, I didn't miss it. You know, I didn't miss it whatsoever. I was in Kenya when my father passed away, which is incredibly sad, and also too, I kind of regret that. I don't resent Kenya, but I regret it. Also to my son, he had a head-on collision in Nairobi. He's okay now. We just celebrated his child's first birthday the other day. But to go through that trauma was horrific. I lost Gabriel, you know, the children's grandfather when I was in Kenya. Lost my dog while I was in Kenya. But having said all that, is just makes you think, oh, gee, I've got a roof over my head. I drive a little car. I live in East Vic Park now, which is a long way from John Street, Cottesloe, but I've got a roof over my head. I've got two fabulous dogs who I share with. I don't have a man in my life, but I am single, just putting it out there.
Right, no problems. No debrief problem. At unforgiving60.com. We are the new Tinder.
Yeah, gosh.
Email. Do you need full body photograph? Or
No, that's cool.
Please send bio
okay,
and headshot
enough.
Only.
I shouldn't have brought it up. I've changed a lot.
Yeah.
I've changed a lot. I'm not getting any younger, and now the sad thing is I have to start looking for a successor now. And that's where I am now. So I changed. I have more patience. I have a stronger sense of humour. Humour gets you through everything. I don't drink as much. but now it's the succession plan. And so, again, I will change because it will be hard to let my baby go. So, again, if there's anyone out there that, you know, wants to have the most incredible life,
Those two things are not mutually exclusive. You can have a relationship with Susan and be the part of the succession plan.
Yeah.
But maybe just differentiate in the email header.
Which one you're more...
Two bios are required. We need your personal bio and final statistics.
I'm blushing
and
now.
Your professional
That's enough.
Bio. Susan, on your blog you said this, and I quote, "Life, I feel, tends to move quickly the older I get. Or is it that I endeavour to pack so much in as there is still so much to do? What do you still need to do?"
Oh, God. So much. Top three. Spend more time with my family.
Because this must be a sacrifice you're making.
Absolutely. I mean, my kids are with me 100%. I've got an incredible daughter in Sydney who's an artist and a son here in Perth, though he is moving to Geelong, but we won't talk about that. But, yeah, spend more time with my family. I only have my Adam and Sarah, my two children, and now my grandson. I don't have any other family. To stop and breathe, you know, I'm a hammock girl. I love lying in a hammock, and, you know, just to with a bottle of wine and not think about budgets, not think about have we got this little girl into hospital in time, not to think, you know, the sadness, you know, that comes with this job, not think about, you know, so many other things. So you just take time and
mindfulness, just being in the moment.
Yeah.
Mm. Some reflection.
Yeah. And I you certainly need that. And I think the third is, I don't know, just be me, but just keep on enjoying, you know, what I do, but maybe spend a little time on me. It may sound a little selfish, but sometimes I want to be in the garden, you know. Sometimes, you know, I want to, you know.
In the context of everything you've said in the last half hour or so, there's probably very little you could say that would sound selfish.
It sounds very selfish to me.
I just want to take time out. I need to take time out for me and my family, and that's the succession plan. I will never hand it over 100%. I'm not that type of person. Mm. You know, I'll always have that finger in the pie. But somebody else needs now to not to carry it on, but to follow on. Mm. You know, it's the most amazing and a gift giving thing. Mm. Doing what I do, I have an incredible life.
And to the Mzungu who are listening to this episode while they're pushing their trolley through the boat shed, how can they help?
Money. Give. It sounds crass, but let's face it. They say, you know, money doesn't make you happy, but I can show you 200,000 people that mm-hmm. need food, and that's just in my area. I can show you operations that are needed. I can show you food that's needed. I can show you so much, and it's money.
What do they need to volunteer?
Volunteer, all they need to do is be able to pay for the airfare. Obviously, we don't, you know, help them with the airfare, but once they get there, you know, we don't charge to volunteer. Everything's on our website. But the thing is, to volunteer, be prepared. You know, be prepared to give yourself. You know, it's not, you're not here for a holiday and say, aren't these kids cute? That's not what it's about.
And how do they find out more about Nakuru Hope?
On the website.
And the website is?
www.nakuruhope.org.
And that's NAKURU, Hope.
Yeah, that's where we're located, in Nakuru of Kenya.
And we'll provide links to that in the show notes. To wrap up, Tim has a notoriously short attention span, so we often ask rapid-fire questions with rapid-fire answers.
Go.
What's your definition of success? Time's up.
I told you his attention span was short.
Believing yourself.
Yeah.
Good answer.
Yeah.
What do you do for yourself?
Very little.
When you carve more time back in, how will you fill it?
Read.
Yeah.
I love writing. Mm-hmm. I want to write my book. Mm-hmm. I've already started, but I'd like to write more. Spend time on lonely beaches and drink.
Deadly combination.
Absolutely.
That sounds very Hemingway.
What book are you reading now?
I'm not reading any book now, mm-hmm. But having an op shop, I have hundreds of books that I want to read. Murder mystery person.
Okay, I was going to say, when you reach for a book, what is it? Murder mystery?
Murder mysteries, thrillers.
Does that say something about your personality,
it
murder
could
mystery?
Do.
You talked about reinvesting in family. If you could do one thing for the family that have supported you whilst you've been overseas, what would that be?
Just be there for them. It's not easy now in our economy. I haven't got the money to give them, but I've got the love, you know, and so just be there for them.
Susan, thank you.
Pleasure.
What a great chat.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, we really appreciate you chatting to us today, and obviously the incredible work you're doing, pretty mind-blowing. Thank you.
Pleasure. Cheers.
One of them's growing, not fast enough. One of them's flowing, not far enough. One of them's crying for what has made it sad. One of them's dying from what it never, ever, ever had.
What did they say? Koheri. Koheri. Goodbye.
Koheri.
Koheri. Goodbye.
Love it.
Wasting away. Birds of a feather. Counting the days. Wishing for leaving. What it's like to be. Sunshine and things that will never be me. I don't wanna see. I've got food in my cheek. I'm food of gold over me. I don't wanna see. I got blood in my cheek. I'm too food of gold over. Wishing for leaving, what it's like to be free, dreaming of sunshine.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.